This is Salman Rushdie.
Hi, this is Julia Sweeney.
I'm Neil deGrasse Tyson.
This is Theo Wilson.
Hi, this is Dar Williams, and you're listening to
the Humanist Network
Humanist
News.
Network
Humanist
News.
Network Humanist News. Network News.
It's July 28th, and you're listening to the Humanist Network News, an audio production of the American Humanist Association. I'm your host, Jess Constantine, and I'd like to introduce a new co-host today, and that is Jennifer Bardi, who is the editor of the Humanist Magazine. Jennifer, welcome to Albany.
Thanks so much, Jess. Great to be here.
Jennifer, what brings you to Albany?
Actually, my being here is very fitting for this episode. I know Jess had announced last program that she would have a number of co-hosts in the future. And I jumped at the chance just because I thought it'd be really fun. But in addition, we have some exciting news, which is that the Humanist Network News podcast is going to go through a name change and is going to come under the purview of the Humanist Magazine. The decision was made. It actually makes quite a bit of sense. To give a little background, the Humanist Magazine is, our tagline is a magazine of critical inquiry and social concern. So I think in addition to providing sort of movement-oriented kind of philosophical musings, the magazine also likes to concentrate on politics and culture and science, all from a humanist perspective. And so we thought it made sense to have the podcast associated with the magazine. And I think it's going to open up some really interesting opportunities for both, some crossover and maybe having some contributors appear on the podcast and so forth.
Definitely. You guys have had some great interviews with folks in your magazine. So I'm hoping personally to get to meet some of those people also in the future to interview them. And I think that we're hoping to follow in your shoes of just sort of covering a general range of what's happening in the world and just giving our perspective on that. And I think that'll be more accessible to people.
Yeah, I like to tell the story. I had a friend, kind of a colleague, who read the magazine, and she told me I don't know that she read it cover to cover, but she read most of it. And she said, by the end of it, she said, oh, I think I'm a humanist.
Yeah.
Which was neat. I mean, I want someone to read the magazine and just be entertained and actually be provoked. But I think the podcast could kind of operate in the same way, that we want someone to discover it for the content and for the topics that we cover,
right,
and then to leave it with a sense of what humanism is.
Yep.
And I just wanted to mention briefly, in terms of the magazine, I mean, it did go through a bit of an evolution in this sense. I think in the early days, it's been published since 1941, but in the early days, The Humanist was more of a philosophical journal. And I think maybe, I'm going to say 30 years ago or so, the decision was made to start covering more contemporary issues from a humanist perspective. And the person that was largely responsible for that is Lloyd Morain, who was the editor of The Humanist for 12 years, was the Humanist of the Year in 1994, and he died recently, earlier this month, in fact, at the ripe age of 93, I should add. And so I did want to just pay a quick tribute to him. He was a really nice guy and led a really interesting life, actually. And I think listeners might be interested to hear about some of the tidbits of his life. Apparently he was the, a palm reader to the stars in Hollywood for a stint. He, grew up really poor, but made, you know, struck his claim and became a real philanthropist, especially for humanist causes, and an author. And like I said, the editor of the magazine. But he always kind of held an affinity for the kind of journeyman, people who used to ride the rails and do eke out a living kind of working here and there, and apparently used to take vacations riding the rails and
nice,
commuting with these people. So all of this will appear in that humanist profile.
Nice. And when can folks expect to see that edition?
That's the September-October issue, so that'll come out at the end of August.
Nice. Well, we've actually got sort of a special show today because we've got Jennifer and myself, both women, co-hosting the show. And I think actually it's the first time that we've ever had two women co-hosting the show.
About time.
That's right. And both segments of our show today feature two women who are the co-recipients of AHA's Humanist Heroine Award. So we're going to be hearing the acceptance speech from Meg Bowman.
And from Annie Laurie Gaylor. These awards were given out at the conference, as they are each year, by the Feminist Caucus. Did you know that the AHA has a Feminist Caucus?
You know, I actually didn't.
It was established in 1977, and it's a coalition of men and women within the AHA that work towards feminist issues, but also to help the AHA in their overall mission to promote humanism.
Right.
And they typically, you know, offer workshops at the conference. They work with the board. And they also work with other feminist groups now, NARAL, et cetera.
Nice. So, and listeners, if you're interested in either joining or supporting, or we've also got a discussion board of some of the issues that they talk about, just go to our website, AmericanHumanist.org, and you can find links to the Feminist Caucus on our website.
And Jess, I actually had the opportunity to sit at the Feminist Caucus table at the conference when they gave out the awards, and it was a real treat. You hear the word sisterhood a lot amongst this group of people, and you really felt that sense, that palpable sense of unity and kind of celebration of their accomplishments in the women's movement. And that sense of sisterhood and their shared history really comes through in the comments from both awardees.
The first clip that we're going to play is Meg Bowman accepting the Humanist Heroine Award. Meg Bowman is a retired sociology professor from San Jose State University, and she's also the author of many books on women's history. Meg is a veteran of the civil rights and peace movements, and she also served a co-chair of the AHA Feminist Caucus for over 9 years.
And her comments, as you'll see, she's a great orator, and she touches on so many humanist issues, including population growth, reproductive freedom, racial constructs, campaign finance reform, the abuse of corporate power, the religious right, and others who, as she says, fan the flames of hatred, global warming, and sexist language. So there are a lot of issues covered, and we're going to kind of, you know, touch on a few in her remarks.
Right. So here's that clip of Meg Bowman at the AHA 69th Annual Conference earlier this summer.
Well, now that I am in my dotage, I'm more opinionated than ever. And I'm less tolerant of people with prejudices, those who use sexist language, materialistic jerks, greedy CEOs, less tolerant of discrimination, misogyny, patriarchy, stupidity, Republicans, and a whole lot of Democrats. A few years ago, while doing research in Spokane, Washington, I visited a friend, and her annoying 7-year-old grandson kept interrupting us with this mantra. Well, what do you know for sure? Well, what do you know for sure? Well, except for the inevitability of death and taxes, I'm reviewing what I know for sure. Yes, I know Bertrand Russell's first commandment is, do not feel absolutely certain about anything. But I know that if each day you do one random act of kindness and give at least one hug, you will be a happier person. I know that, to quote Art Jackson, humanism is the key to human progress. And I know that the future is up to us. The future is now. Eternity is now. The future, or eternity, is not something that begins after you are dead. It is going on all the time. We are in it now. And one thing I know for sure is that no one is born before their time. We need those on the cutting edge, those out-of-the-box people, to pave the way for social change, who inspire us, the Emma Goldmans, Margaret Sangers, Barbara Lees, or as the late, great Dorothy Height said, if the time is not ripe, we have to ripen the time. We not only need leaders who share our values, who work to promote the common good, such as peace and equal rights, we need our friends. How many times has your own light flickered and is rekindled by a spark from another person? Each of us has cause to think with deep gratitude of those who have lighted the flame within us. What else do I know for sure? Well, in politics and religion, I am not a mugwump. I do not sit on the fence with my mug on one side and my wump on the other. Independent, strong women do not hesitate to say what's on their mind. So here are a few things I know for sure. There will never be peace on this little planet until there's an end to patriarchy. The other lie or myth is that men are superior to women. That men have that men have the innate right to have power over women and over children, over the earth and serfs and slaves and governments and corporations and religions and education and the media and well, everything. In order to sell this lie, this myth, this BS, the top men, the all-boys club, needed a hierarchy. And at the top of their hierarchy, they needed an all-powerful male god, one big bad honcho, to validate their power and to control the people. Zeus, Thor, Yahweh, Allah, God, whatever. The divine right of kings? What a crock! And because of this lie, this myth, the male of our species, everywhere, are socialized to feel entitled, and these feelings of entitlement are called double standards, sexism, male chauvinism, and patriarchy, which leads to rapes, wife beating, sexual harassments, wage differentials, female genital mutilation, suttees, witch burning, burkas, child raise, etiquette. Well, it's the denigration of women and girls. The women's movement, from Mary Wollstonecraft, Susan B. Anthony, to Laurie Williams and Rosemary Matson and Annie Laurie Gaylor, is the most important social movement in history, challenging patriarchy. Male power, the oldest of injustices, is now a worldwide social movement. And many of us in this room can proudly proclaim that, yes, we were and are a part of the women's liberation movement. I remember a time when the concept of equal right did not exist, when women of all ages were girls, when abortion was a back alley procedure, when there was no such thing as a rape crisis center or a shelter for battered women, when sexual harassment had not yet been named or defined. I remember when we didn't even have words for date rape or glass ceiling. We will also never have peace on this little planet until we create a better economic system, a better method than cutthroat capitalism, to gather and distribute the earth's goods. Food crops, cotton mines, whatever. A better way than a giant crap game, and to have our country controlled by six greedy banks with their predatory lending practices, men being paid $10 million a day, huge bonuses with taxpayers' money, massive fraud shenanigans throughout Wall Street, sophisticated scams, and kickbacks. If you're too big to fail, you're too damn big. I don't know if we're going to get regulations or real controls or a Federal Consumer Protection Agency. You know, the corporations have already spent over $500 million in the 2010 elections. And I'm sure you all heard about the Security Exchange Commission, supposed to oversee banks. Instead, the SEC boys were watching pornography while they were watching the wrong people getting screwed. We know that war is a racket, a way for corporations to make money, lots of money. We know that the United States has become a perpetual war machine, and we know that corporations are not persons. During the 70s and 80s and into the 90s, women had consciousness-raising groups all over the country. And one of our issues was to reduce or eliminate sexist language. And we did a pretty good job. But now, gender-exclusive language is back. Newspapers, magazines, TV, even PBS are back to using mankind instead of humankind or humanity, even President Obama. Back to calling a woman chairman, check out Ebony Magazine. We know that girls and women feel left out when sexist, gender-exclusive language is used. And please stop saying, as Dr. Phil and Oprah and Dr. Oz, and even a woman I adore, Rachel Maddow of MSNBC, they will look directly at several females and say, well, now you guys, can you imagine anyone looking directly at several men and saying, well, now you gals, stop calling females you guys. Guys is not generic. It's sexist. It's gender exclusive language, and stop it. Lastly, I am a sociologist, and I know for sure, as homo saps, as animals, we are a complex interrelationship between genes and environment. We are products of nature and nurture. I study primarily nurture. We are products of our environment and our ascribed status, the family, the time, the place, the society, the culture, the socialization, indoctrination, brainwashing, education we were born into. Robert McAfee Brown noted, who you listen to determines what you hear. Where you stand determines what you see. What you do determines who you are. We humans learn language, values, behavior norms. We learn our roles, our ascribed status, and how open our society is. I come from the prairies of North Dakota at a time when girls received a basic education, with the restriction that girls become a teacher, secretary, or nurse. I became a teacher, and my sister became a nurse. And of course, we were all expected to get married and have children, which I did several times. But there were books to read, and there were the suffragists and other foremothers of the women's movement. And when I graduated from high school, a civil rights movement, and then a peace movement emerging, I loved the sit-ins, the civil rights marches, helping to set up the Mississippi Freedom Schools, working for fair housing and desegregation, and I never missed a peace march here in the Bay Area. And I love the women's movement, the issues, the organization, the sisterhood. For most of us in this room, what a time we have lived. We, you and I, initiated and supported social change, and we are still making a difference. This is an incredible time to be alive. But remember, it takes social action. So write those letters, sign those petitions, support your candidate, join that march, and be sure to give $15 to the Feminist Caucus. Well, one thing I don't know for sure is the future. Some futurists are optimistic, like Marge and Bert Liebert's book, Out of the Cage. But most futurists are pessimistic, and they see the world being run by very greedy multinational corporations, nothing done about global warming, and corporations controlling politicians, which is the definition of fascism. Fascism is corporatism. If you don't like the F word, call it plutocracy. Plutocracy is rule by the rich to get richer. And as you know, today, the top 1% now own more financial wealth than the bottom 90%. So let me close by describing a more optimistic, a feminist scenario. Gloria Steinem is a humanist and a leading feminist. Last year, for her 75th birthday, her birthday wishes for 25 years hence, the year 2034, she asked for the following. Quote, on the news, women and men, all ages and colors, report on what went right as well as what went wrong. All media has a peace correspondent reporting on conflict resolution without war. Men are interviewed on how they combine career and family. As many men as women care for the baby. People accept their own unique bodies. No more breast implants, nose jobs, liposuctions. And shopping malls are turned into really nice schools, community centers, and parks. And this is possible because people only buy what they really need or love. Schools and children's centers have the military budget, and the military is used only for disaster relief and peacekeeping. So what do I know for sure? What would I like for the future? Well, I want what Gloria wants. But, you know, an end to all wars and full equality for women, little things. Universal single-payer health care for everyone would be fine. How about, for the first time, a woman honorary president of the American Humanist Association? We can do that. And lastly, to show that our nation has truly gotten over its prejudices, now this is after Obama's 8 years, how about a woman elected president of the United States, well, who is openly gay, a vegetarian, a feminist, and why not, a secular humanist? Remember that the future is up to us. So will each and every one of you in a big loud voice repeat after me. If it's to be,
it's to be.
It's up to you and me.
It's up to you and me.
Thank you.
That was Meg Bowman receiving the Humanist Heroine of the Year Award at AHA's 69th Annual Conference earlier this summer. If you'd like more information about the Feminist Caucus, visit AmericanHumanist.org.
As listeners can tell, that was a very well-received speech that she gave.
Yeah.
But I also think it's worth noting that feminist issues for humanists, of course, have always been at the forefront of humanist values and so forth. I mean, affirming the inherent worth and dignity of each individual. Of course, goes along with feminism and with women's issues. But it's interesting because there's also a very civil libertarian bent to humanist thought and issues of privacy. And there have been times when these have been in conflict, you know, feminist issues and kind of the privacy issues and civil libertarian issues.
Right.
But I think it's worth noting that what humanists like to do most when there are difficult issues is to continue to bat them around and to discuss and try to come to some resolution. And so I think you'll always find these are issues of great interest to humanists and exploring ways that, you know, these issues may divide us and how we can unite around them and so forth.
Right.
The next issue of the Humanist magazine, I wanted to mention, is going to cover a number of interesting feminist issues, women's issues, namely pornography and the wearing of Islamic dress codes, namely the burqa bans that are in fashion in Western Europe right now. Not to overly conflate the two topics, but just to look at the issues of choice in relation to these two topics.
Right.
So this is just, you know, feminism a go-go. Maybe you should queue up the Helen Reddy right now.
Absolutely.
I am woman, hear me roar, in numbers too big to ignore.
Hey, Jess, do you know how many feminists it takes to screw in a light bulb?
No, I got nothing. How many?
That's not funny.
What do you mean? I didn't answer anything.
That's the punchline.
Oh. That's awesome.
Think about that.
I will.
Good. So next up is the second recipient of the Humanist Heroine Award, Annie Laurie Gaylor. And I think you'll find that her style differs quite a bit from Meg's.
Absolutely.
But they are both united in their causes.
Yep. And both equally powerful, in my opinion.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Annie Laurie Gaylor is co-founder and co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. And you've already heard a little bit about this organization as we've talked about their lawsuit to try and to declare that the National Day of Prayer is unconstitutional. So back in April of 2010, U.S. District Judge Barbara Crabb did declare the National Day of Prayer unconstitutional. And this decision is now being reviewed by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. So here is Annie telling the story.
Thank you so much, Stephanie. She did a lot of work, and I'd like to thank the Feminist Caucus and also Pat Willis, who's not here. And I'm delighted to share this lovely honor, humanist co-heroine, with Meg Bowman. And she's been my intrepid, undaunted, indefatigable feminist co-chair for many years. And when Dan dropped me off at the airport, he reminded me that the name Meg anagrams to Gem. And she is one. And she has given, she's a hard act to follow. She has given the big picture, so therefore I'm going to tell you just a little small story. And it would be remiss not on this occasion not to say something about women in humanism and feminism, and I'll do that at the end. But Stephanie did ask me to talk about the inside story about our National Day of Prayer victory, and that's what I'm going to do. How we came to take and win a beautiful federal court ruling on April 15th in our favor, declaring the National Day of Prayer unconstitutional. Victories this sweet, this historic, don't often happen. It isn't every day that you get an order from a court enjoining the President of the United States, and it's a victory to savor while we have it. And it began very innocuously, really, in the spring of 2008 when I got a complaint from one of our members in Burnett County, Wisconsin, about a loose cannon sheriff in Burnett County who was organizing his 8th National Day of Prayer breakfast using sheriff's letterhead, using the county, using their money, and inviting people on this letterhead to a prayer breakfast on May 1st of that year with a speaker who happened to be the Wisconsin State Supreme Court Justice-elect, Michael Gableman. Boy, was this a violation, and describing Judge Gableman as a man who is deeply committed to our Lord, his religion, and his profession. I love the order of that. And that caught my eye because Michael Gableman had unseated the only African-American Supreme Court justice through nefarious means and corporate unwholesome partnerships, and he was under investigation. And we couldn't really write a letter to a seated Supreme Court justice, but we could write a letter to the sheriff, and I told him, quit sponsoring the National Day of Prayer through your office. And I pointed out in a press release that Congress should never have inaugurated a National Day of Prayer. It simply has encouraged public officials with theocratic tendencies to misuse their public office to promote or endorse religion. And this was a belligerent sheriff. He fought back. He refused initially to answer my open records request. He described himself in the media as a man of the Lord. He acted persecuted. He attacked us. And I wanted to sue him very badly. So I called up FFRF's typical litigation attorney. He's with a law firm in Madison, Wisconsin, Rich Bolton, has won a lot of cases for us, and he looked over the facts, and he said, yeah, I think we could win. He agreed to take the case, but we couldn't find a plaintiff. The initial complainant had an airtight reason why she could not go public, and our other members either didn't want to or had other conflicts. And I even asked, is Bob Ritter here? I asked Bob to send an email to HA members in Burnett County. I think they were all the same as our members. Nobody came forward. So I was stymied and thwarted and very disappointed. And so I kind of bitterly complained to Rich that the National Day of Prayer ruins my life every spring. We have all these violations and I can never do anything about them. And they're basically unresolvable because they spring from this federal law, a national law, that requires the President of the United States to declare a National Day of Prayer and to give a prayer proclamation. The President is creating very bad precedent. And Rich had never looked at the National Day of Prayer, never had thought about a lawsuit before, and he was very intrigued. It always pays to have a fresh pair of eyes look at a problem. And he looked at the website of the National Day of Prayer Task Force, which I was familiar with, and realized that this private Christian evangelical group, which is been accused of hijacking the National Day of Prayer, look like a government agency. And they issue the proclamation, and they were bragging that not only had President Bush adopted their wording in 2008, and not only had 50 of the governors issued a prayer proclamation, but 30 of them had regurgitated back the wording provided by this Christian evangelical group. And they provide Bible verses and scripture and themes that link piety and prayer. And they bragged that they had 30 to 40,000 events a year around the country on public property, wherever possible. And that they also bragged on their website, it was very clear, that they limited the coordinators, volunteers, and speakers to those who share evangelical beliefs that the Bible is inerrant and there is one true Lord, Jesus Christ. The divisiveness of these events had hit the news in recent years that Hindus, Muslims, Jews had been excluded. And of course, at the Freedom from Religion Foundation, we had fielded complaints from non-believers for years about the injury of being told by our president to pray. And not only am I told to pray, I'm told to pray every year. I'm told to set aside an entire day for prayer. I'm told, if possible, to go to church to pray. And I'm even told what to pray about. We're given a laundry list by the president that usually links patriotism and piety. And so Rich looked at this huge big picture and he said, well, wait a minute. The government and an evangelical Christian ministry are working hand in glove. And this shows governmental preference and endorsement for one particular religious conviction. And bingo, we had ourselves a federal lawsuit that was a lot bigger than Burnett County. So we decided to file suit. We named President George Bush, which is always was always very satisfying. And we named his press secretary because it's hard to sue the president. And so the press secretary technically issues the proclamation. And then Rich had sort of a genius idea to further name Shirley Dobson of the National Day of Prayer Task Force as co-defendant. And boy, was she mad about that. And so after we filed the lawsuit, we got the story behind the creation of the National Day of Prayer. I thought I knew a lot about it, but boy, it was a revelation, truly. It was the idea we learned of Reverend Billy Graham. In 1952, he was having a six-week crusade at the Capitol. He was on the steps of the Capitol saying, what a thrilling, glorious thing it would be to see the leaders of our country kneeling before Almighty God in prayer every year. So he proposed that Congress require the president to proclaim an annual prayer proclamation, a national day of prayer. And this idea was almost instantaneously, practically overnight, enacted by Congress. And one of the champions of the proposal was a senator named Absalom Robertson of Virginia. Do you know whose father he was? Pat. And then we discovered, and this really burned me up, that the federal law was based on a lie. It's in the congressional record that the founders of our country prayed when they adopted the Constitution. And this is a total fabrication. So we also had this, it was a very good piece of information to uncover. But I think that I don't need to over-explain why this is a lie, as Gore Vidal was saying. You're an informed audience. You know that the religious right conflates and confuses the Continental Congress, which adopted the Articles of Confederation, with the Constitution that later supplanted it. And they did pray over the Constitution, the Articles of Confederation, which were a historically dismal failure of 8 years. They did not pray when they adopted our secular and godless Constitution, the longest-lived Constitution in history. And this is one of the reasons that my mother's motto is, nothing fails like prayer, and nothing succeeds like a godless Constitution. The nature of the National Day of Prayer became much more aggressive and in-your-face by 1988. Once again, it was the religious right that suggested a change in the law, Vonette Bright, and she's not going to join the Brights out there in the hall. She's co-founder with a rather famous group called Campus Crusade for Christ with her husband, Bill Bright, and she was serving on this kind of stealth national prayer committee. It still exists. And she hopped on a plane, and she personally lobbied Congress for making the National Day of Prayer, which had been a floating date, any day but a Sunday was the law, into a fixed date, the first Thursday in May. She said that we need a day in this country where we cover this nation and its leaders in prayer. Pat Boone was the co-chair of the National Prayer Committee. He testified on behalf of the bill, complaining how hard it was to mobilize politicians and mobilize the people when the date kept changing. And sponsors included Strom Thurmond and Jesse Helms, and they put into the record their very clearly unsecular purpose to help these evangelical groups mobilize prayer. Reagan signed that bill immediately into law. He invited evangelicals to a prayerful ceremony at the White House, and this became a GOP National Day of Prayer White House custom. And Bright went on to become the first chair of a group called the National Day of Prayer Task Force, whose mission is to write the proclamations, publish them, give them to the president, and try to twist the arms of all politicians, all 50 governors, for example, to sign them. Shirley Dobson, who's the wife of Focus on the Family founder James Dobson, became its honorary chair, and it's still there, housed at Focus on the Family headquarters in Colorado Springs. Shirley Dobson revealed in a deposition that's a hoot to read when Rich flew out there to depose her, that God chooses the theme every year. She goes to God and prays, and he tells her the annual theme and scripture verse that they should use. Isn't that handy? So we filed the lawsuit, and then we received the Bush administration's 56-page motion to dismiss in January 2009. So this is right before the Obama inauguration, and then Obama became our defendant. And this motion to dismiss was full of religious right disinformation and insinuations, everything but the kitchen sink. It was kind of, my heart kind of sank when I saw literally every line had some myth or lie that we needed to correct. And it became our goal that if nothing else, we would correct the history, we would correct the historic record and not let the White House get away with any more disinformation and leave no religious right insinuation or lie uncorrected. And Dan and I and our first staff attorney, who just been hired, spent most of February 2009 researching it while Rich took on the standing issues and all the really serious legal hurdles. And then we had another month, not scheduled, that I knew we were going to have to do when we did discovery against the Obama administration and they did discovery against us. And that was another month turning our office upside down. But that turned out to be kind of a non-godsend, because we put all the information together from 25 to 30 years of complaints that the foundation had received from our membership, the things that we had done to try to combat the National Day of Prayer, and it made our standing. And we never have worked so hard or fought so hard to stay in court. Just a little aside, the Alliance Defense Fund was representing Shirley Dobson, and ACLJ, which is Pat Robertson's legal arm, was representing some 30 members of Congress that wanted to intervene. And the ADF how many of you have heard of the Alliance Defense Fund? You know, they cause a lot of trouble. They have a $40+ million annual budget. It's a Christian legal society. They're anti-abortion, anti-gay, mainly pro-theocracy. And they had the nerve in their motions and in their publicity to continually accuse the Freedom From Religion Foundation of filing our National Day of Prayer challenge to make money. I mean, we had spent $50,000 on legal expenses last year on the National Day of Prayer case alone, which is a lot for the first round of a lawsuit, but this is a very complicated lawsuit. Our total intake for our legal fund in 2009 was only $52,000. We spent more than $112,000. We have 9 cases going. So we did not make money on our lawsuits, I wish, but the religious right is cashing in. And the case went to rest after December. I was deposed for nearly a day by an Obama attorney and an attorney with the Alliance Defense Fund, and they videotaped it just to make it extra intimidating. And toward the end of this very exhausting day, the Obama attorney got kind of tough with me, and he set up a series of questions to try to make the National Day of Prayer look innocuous by comparing it with Columbus Day. And I was asked questions I had to answer kind of yes or no. Did I know there was a federal law that we have to observe Columbus Day? Yes. Did I know that the president had to give a proclamation? Yes. Did I know that there are people who didn't like it? Yes. You know, Native Americans had protested it. Did I know that? Yes. Did I know that, nevertheless, the president asks all people to observe Columbus Day? Well, aside from that difference, apples and oranges, between Columbus Day and an Establishment Clause violation, I finally pointed out with some asperity, that the difference between Columbus Day and the National Day of Prayer is that there really was a historic Columbus. But that nobody can prove there's a God who answers prayer. And that shut him up. So, on April 15th, we were overjoyed. It took us totally by surprise. I wasn't expecting a decision that soon, to learn that federal judge Barbara Crabb had issued a 66-page ruling in our favor. And if you haven't read the decision, it's big type. It doesn't take long. It's at our website at ffrf.org. You can Google it. It's going to make your day if you haven't read it. But I'll just read two sentences. Judge Barbara Crabb wrote, "In this instance, the government has taken sides on a matter that must be left to individual conscience. Recognizing the importance of prayer to many people does not mean that the government may enact a statute in support of it, any more than the government may encourage citizens to fast during the month of Ramadan, attend a synagogue, purify themselves in a sweat lodge, or practice rune magic." And I loved that rune magic. And you probably know that the Obama administration waited less than a week to appeal, and Judge Crabb did enjoin the president, but she stayed that pending an appeal. And we have been super busy since April 15th. We've signed up more than 1,000 new members and fielded requests for information from thousands more who liked that decision. But mostly we've been very busy trying to capitalize on the momentum of our case and to try to take our case to the court of public opinion. And we hope you'll help us to continue to educate that it is a fact that the United States rests on a secular constitution. We do not want to let the religious right hijack our secular constitution. And now I do want to conclude with a little cheerleading about the role of women in the free thought secular humanist movements. And I don't know how many of you heard that there's a new film that has come to our country debuting yesterday, probably in Los Angeles, certainly in New York City, called Agora. How many of you have heard of that? Few of you. Well, it's about a bona fide humanist heroine, Hypatia, the great female scholar and philosopher and head of the University of Alexandria in the 4th century. Rachel Weisz is the actress. Amenabar is the director. It's getting rave reviews in the New York Times. And it tells basically the story of what happened when Christianity took over Alexandria. Hypatia was literally torn into pieces and into shreds by a mob of Christian monks during the sacking of Alexandria that basically ushered in the Dark Ages. As my friend, the late Ruth Green, author of The Born Again Skeptic's Guide to the Bible, put it, there was a time when religion ruled the world. It is known as the Dark Ages. And I think one of the reasons that women have tended to play leadership roles in the humanist and free thought movements is that because we have so much to lose if religion is united with government, and so much to gain by freeing ourselves from religion. More people have been killed, men and women, in the name of religion or God than for any other reason. But I think feminists today are very aware of the fact in the West, we're uncomfortably aware of the fact of the witch hunts. We know that tens of thousands, if not millions, of women lost their lives, were individually hunted down, prosecuted, tortured, and put to death because of one Bible verse in a book that we are still told is a good book, and which upwards of 45% of the population thinks is literal, and which many theocratic groups are insisting should be the basis of our government. So it's true that the primary catalyst for my mother and myself in founding the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the wake-up call for us, was seeing the role of organized religion in fighting to oppose women's rights. We felt that we needed to get to the root of the problem and to combat, in the thrilling words of Elizabeth Cady Stanton, we needed to strike the blow at the fountain of all tyranny, religious superstition, priestly power, and the canon law. But you could equally look at the religious tyranny against gay rights and marriage equality, stem cell research against the teaching and understanding of evolution, and why in the United States we find ourselves in this terrible pickle, in this outlandish and frightening predicament of having more than half the population, our adult population, embrace creationism. And this makes the U.S. an ideal culture in which to grow more fundamentalists and Tea Partiers, and what Richard Dawkins calls the faith heads, and Clarence Darrow called the clock stoppers. Our country's unwholesome allegiance to religion has retarded progress, and it threatens our future. And as Ruth Green observed, Stephanie quoted her earlier, freedom depends on free thinkers, and we can all be freedom fighters, and it doesn't take that much work. I would challenge everyone in this room to do one simple thing, and that is to always correct the historic record. Never let the big lies of the religious right go uncorrected, and that's the way we will restore respect for the uniquely American principle of separation between church and state. Thank you so much for this award.
That was the 2010 humanist heroine, Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And I thought that was really, a really interesting story. Well, the part of the story I thought was really interesting was how they hit upon this new strategy in dealing with the National Day of Prayer and kind of took it, you know, very to the top. And I did want to tell you, Jess, that the case is obviously, as you said, being reviewed.
Right.
But I read recently the Family Research Council and the Liberty Institute, both religious right legal arms, are actually filing a brief. They're accusing the Obama administration of not going far enough in their defense of National Day of Prayer. And basically, in essence, they don't really trust them to win the appeal.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. So they're trying to get on board and kind of move in there and take hold of the legal arm.
I wonder how that will play out.
I wonder what would happen if Bush were still president.
Yeah, I'm assuming that they would trust in his abilities.
Right. As we all did.
Well, Jennifer, that about wraps up our show for this month.
Well, thanks for having me, Jess. I hope you'll have me back.
Absolutely. I would love to.
And thanks, too, for letting me plug the Humanist magazine. I think this new collaboration is going to be really fruitful all around and really looking forward to it.
Yeah. And listeners, if you're interested, you can subscribe. You can read online versions. And you can just, in general, learn more about the Humanist magazine at our website, thehumanist.org. And you'll also notice that that's where you'll find the podcast as well. But until then, you can still download and read about past episodes and find any of the links that we've mentioned on our show at our current podcast page, which is humanistpodcast.org. As always, I'd love your feedback. I'd love to have any suggestions on future shows or future guests or anything like that. So please send me an email at hnn@americanhumanist.org. You can also find that letter to the producer link on our podcast page, humanistpodcast.org.
Now, Jess,
yes.
What about that new name?
That's right, our new name. We are going to have a new name, and it's going to be debuted next month.
Brought to you by Bill Nye.
That's right. Bill Nye is going to tell you what our new podcast name is, so make sure you check it out.
Cool.
Folks, thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your guest host, Jennifer Barty.
Love me, do forget me not. Played out just like an afterthought. So I'm through being your leftover.